Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Isco.
And I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, McGruff, the crime dog who was sickened by this film and could not be here.
It's true. Just absolutely repelled by this film. With us today, our guest is Casey Lee Clark, who... Thank you so much for coming on, Casey. Oh,
thank you for having me. I'm such a fan of both of you and of this podcast, so it's really an honor to be here.
That is very, very kind of you. I mean, I'm also a fan of Emily, obviously. But
thank you. I think you're great, Phil. You seem... We've never actually met. We just do podcasts together.
It's super weird. We only just talk on Zoom. So I reached out to you, Casey, and I was like, I'd love to have you on the podcast. What films from 1992 would you be interested in talking about? And you gave me a handful of films, and Unlawful Entry was one of those films, a film that I think I get mixed up in my brain with two other films that came out in the early 90s. Internal Affairs, the Richard Gere movie where he also plays an evil LAPD cop, and then Ricochet, which is the Denzel Washington movie where I believe he's trying to kill John Lithgow and he is also an LAPD cop. I think I say all of this because Emily and I were texting as we were watching this film, and it seemed as though Emily was talking about how when you were younger, the LAPD or just police officers, let's just say police officers,
yes.
We're all good. All good guys.
I grew up in rural South Dakota. Our town had one cop, and like all he did was give people speeding tickets. That was his whole thing. He didn't even really give people, you know, drunk driving tickets. On occasion, he'd be like, yeah, you shouldn't be doing it. He had the nicest, easiest job in the world. He was still kind of a dick because he was a cop, but I remember. I was a movie obsessed kid, even though I didn't get to see movies. This is the first time I've ever seen this movie. I read about the premise of this movie, an evil cop, and I was like, whoa, that's a wild premise. That is a good premise because it's so like it's not what you'd expect. You would not expect there to be an evil cop. And like I was cognizant of like the Rodney King beating. I was cognizant of all these things. But like to me, a cop was like the guy in my town who sat behind the billboard to try and catch people in a speed trap. That was who a cop was. So this movie.
Cop in Springfield in The Simpsons.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like what's his name from The Dukes of Hazzard? I don't remember his name. That's what a police officer was to me.
Yeah, I also come from that kind of an area. Maybe a couple more cops and more of random alcohol checkpoints. But otherwise, yeah, it was very much speeding and drunk driving and teenagers.
Where are you from originally, Casey?
I'm originally from Bel Air, Maryland. Now, to be fair, then my other view of cops is being north of Baltimore. So, you know, you have the dichotomy there.
Sure. You get The Wire or you get The Simpsons. Yeah.
But then I went to school in Philly. So then I lived in Philly for 8 years. So also similar to Baltimore in the relationship with the
spectrum.
Police. Yeah.
Sure.
I really do think, you know, like I'm not trying to give the people who are, you know, don't understand police protests too much credit, but I do think like there is that thing where I had to learn, oh no, the police are often very terrible. In fact, as a structural force, the police are the worst. And like, maybe there's like one or two good cops, but they're like wildly outnumbered because I grew up in a place where there was one guy and we all knew his name. And he was like, just don't get too drunk. And you were like, okay, Mr. Police Officer. Cause he didn't want to fucking do anything. He wanted to just sit there.
So I'm from Toronto originally, Casey. And so the idea of a police force, I mean, Toronto is obviously a major metropolitan city, but
they're Mounties, right? You just have Mounties.
They're all on horseback. They all look like Dudley Do-Right. I never felt a police presence per se. You know what I mean? In the sense that, you know, I came from a, you know, relatively upper middle class area of Toronto, and I just never really felt much of a presence. But as I texted you, Emily, T2 was the movie that made me realize that police officers are bad, because obviously the T-1000 is dressed like an LAPD cop for the majority of that film.
Listen, I got a take on that too, which is,
I bet you do.
When I saw it, because I did see that movie around this time, I think I saw that right around when I heard about Unlawful Entry, and I was like, oh, he's disguised as a cop because everyone trusts cops. That's a really good twist.
Wow, you were just fully in on this cops are good.
I didn't actually think cops were good. I was young and was raised to just trust authority because I was raised an evangelical Christian. I remember there was a time when we were watching a football game and the referee made a call and I was like, that's a bad call. And my father, just not a very good person. I gotta say that as a disclaimer. But my father said, no, it's the right call. The referee made it. Therefore, it's the right call. And I was like,
oh my,
you know what? That was the first time when I was like, I'm not sure I agree with you.
This authority bit, questionable. So Casey, you, I'm assuming, did not see this film in 1992 because I imagine you weren't even born yet, is my guess.
You would be correct.
Okay. When did you see this film and why did you pick this film?
I saw this in college, my senior year of college. I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, as I said before. I took a film noir class, and weirdly enough, my professor was very into like these genre type classes as more of an idea than like like we didn't watch like Double Indemnity. We watched Unlawful Entry. Like that's where my professor went with it. I think it was like a thing of like the detective slash cop type character being the antagonist. It was the way of looking at it there. And this was actually the class where I met my boyfriend in. So we both were like kind of reminiscing on like, remember Unlawful Entry? It was also, I think, like the first or second week of our classes. This was one of those classes. I know, yeah. Where it was one of those classes where it was only once a week for like 4 hours. And so we would watch like one or two movies in the class. And this was, I had added my film minor like kind of in the middle of my college career. I have a theater degree. And so this was my first class where we would watch the movies like in class. And this was my first time being in a college class where they showed like a sex scene in a movie. And I remember sitting there being like, we're all just going to watch this. We're all here together. Okay.
I mean, it is interesting because I think that, and you know, Emily, we've talked about this a little bit in terms of this sort of the amount of erotic thrillers, adult movies with adult themes in terms of all of that. Thus far, you know, we've done Single White Female and Basic Instinct, Consenting Adults, Poison Ivy,
I'm sure I'm missing some as well that we've already. Oh, Final Analysis. This is all to say that, like, they all are kind of noirish, right?
Yeah.
I mean, am I crazy to say that? So, like, your professor wasn't completely off base.
Yeah. This is kind of a noir. Yeah.
It's very funny that, I think it's also one of those. The other reason that I picked it was that it's just a very random movie that I happen to have seen. And random in the sense of being like, I saw this before I saw Goodfellas. That's just strange and should not be a thing.
Emily?
But, like, you know. Listen. Yeah.
No, I mean, I've seen a bunch of movies before I saw Goodfellas. So I think that's
that's fair. Yeah.
Let's just be honest. I saw the movie Prancer before I saw Goodfellas, and I'm not sure that should have been allowed either. So
since you brought up Goodfellas, I have to say that every time Ray Liotta says Karen in this movie,
I know.
Breaks my brain. Like, just change your name. Change the character's name. Like, why? It just, I couldn't process it. It was just too much for me. But I do think, I had not seen this film either. Emily, we both watched this for the first time. I had a notion of this film, just based on its title, that there would be some sort of breaking and entering going on. But outside of that, I really didn't know much about this film.
This movie's got like 5 or 6 unlawful entries. Like,
it does. It's got a lot of them. It should be called Unlawful Entries, really. Yeah.
that's for the limited series that you're pitching around town.
Yes, unlawful absolutely. Entries. Right now.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, I do think that this film fits very kind of nicely into this early 90s thriller thing of like high stakes drama to adults and sort of how your life can be disrupted by basically another person. If it's an evil nanny, if it's an evil, I don't know, evil writer. I mean, there's all sorts of just evil people and how they come into your lives. I do think that, because it feels like...
No. Yeah. Evil people and how they come into your lives is a great Reader's Digest feature. Like...
But it's true, though. Like, it does feel like there was this litany, this list of, like, how can we do thrillers relatively on the cheap, mm-hmm. right? Because, like, none of this stuff... I mean, the movies that we've done thus far, like, I think the most expensive one is probably Basic Instinct at this point. I could be wrong. Like,
that makes sense.
Most of these movies are, like, $20, $30 million at most.
Yeah.
And even then, like, this movie had a budget of $21 million, and I'm like... I don't know where the $21 million went exactly.
All those camera moves, you know,
all those cameras, a lot of camera
shots of LA.
It's true.
I'm interested in comparing this to the erotic thriller because I don't think it's an erotic thriller at all, but I think it could have been. I think if you had cast someone other than Ray Liotta, and I want to be clear, I think Ray Liotta fucking rules in this movie. Mm-hmm. So good. But also, he's playing it so straight and so intense that there's no eroticism to it at all. He's just like, I'm a crazy cop and I'm going to come and fuck up your life. And you're like, well, that's scary. That's not erotic at all. But like, I can imagine the version of this script that made people be like, oh, there's some sexiness here. And like, there's still like the vestigial organ remains of that.
Well, yeah,
he's like a shark, like, in this movie. Yeah. Like, he just devours their life as opposed to like wanting to have sex with her.
Well, and it's also the I would compare it to the complaint / criticism that I've heard people have of Jack Nicholson in The Shining of like, he's crazy from the beginning. You know, you're like, why is the Ray Liotta a cop? What's up with this?
He's kind of sweet at the beginning, but I do agree that like, he's Ray Liotta. So like, he's intense. Yeah. So like, there's already that intensity coming from him. Like, he just radiates that uneasiness.
I think it also definitely reminds me of his performance in Something Wild.
Yes.
Where he's also kind of off of rocker. So.
No, totally. He feels dangerous in that movie from the drop, like from the second he shows up. In this movie, I think you're supposed to be disarmed by him up top, right? Like, he's supposed to kind of be just a nice guy who's trying to make their lives better. But it is interesting to look at the people that were almost cast in this role, or my apologies, turned down this role. The four people were Mel Gibson, Tom Berenger, John Travolta, and Charlie Sheen.
Now, Travolta, I can see playing this the way that he did in Face Off. That's what I feel the type of vibe we would get.
Yes.
But that's also Travolta pre Pulp Fiction. So it's also a different,
yes,
you know, time for him.
That's well. Like, that's like Look Who's Talking time, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of his finest performances, honestly. He's so good in Look Who's Talking. I had to change my background because I'm getting tired of sitting over.
Sitting in that. It's better that you be in between your two husbands.
Between my two husbands, yeah.
I think that the Mel Gibson thing is interesting, mm-hmm, but like almost too big a star, I think, on some level.
Yeah. Although I think the reason that this film, and we'll get into it, but still I think holds up and is interesting is because you have, I think, two basically movie stars / charismatic actors, mm-hmm, as these two, mm-hmm, roles, where I feel like if you had one of them as like some actor that didn't go anywhere, I don't think it would work as well.
I totally agree. And I also feel like they look similar and they kind of have similar energies. Like they're, mm-hmm, kind of like Ray Liotta is sort of an evil version of Kurt Russell to some degree. Like they're not at the same level of fame by any means. I think Kurt Russell's a much bigger star than Ray Liotta is, but I do feel like they kind of have a similar yin and yang thing. They're on your shoulders right now, Emily. How do you feel about them?
I feel like, I do feel like they honestly devil angel. Kurt, mm-hmm, Russell's the angel, really is the devil.
Especially Kurt Russell, that little dimple, definitely.
Yeah. I think that this was a point in time when Ray Liotta seemed ascendant and Kurt Russell was a little bit plateauing. Mm-hmm. So I can see where they were like, oh, we're going to catch him right at the same point. It didn't quite work out that way, but I just want to read to you. I got this photo from Ray Liotta's Facebook page. And just to describe it to everyone, because you're probably not actually watching this on the Patreon, because like five people do. It's a pretty standard like press still that is like, we're sending this out to just let people instantly know the relationships of the characters in the movie. Kurt Russell is on the right and Madeline Stowe is in the middle. She's hugging him. You're supposed to be like, they are a couple. And then Ray Liotta is glowering menacingly off to the left. And you're like, oh, he's the threat here. Anyway, Ray Liotta shared this on his Facebook page. This is the caption. Wow. This photo was taken while filming a movie called Unlawful Entry with Kurt Russell and Madeline Stowe. They were great. It was directed by Jonathan Kaplan, who is still one of my favorite directors. If you haven't seen it, I have to say it's a great movie. It's a thriller. I've had people tell me it scared them to death because the premise of the movie can actually happen. Loved working with everyone on this one. # Throwback Thursday. Thanks, Ray Liotta.
Nice.
Yeah, that's true.
I like that.
Like, it's very R. nice. RIP really. Like the premise of this movie could actually happen. Yeah, you know, it could.
Yeah,
that's,
it really
that's
could.
What's really scary.
It is interesting what you just mentioned, Emily, of the sort of the arcs of their careers and where they sort of were at these kind of converging moments. My assumption as well is that like the names that were brought up for the Michael Carr role that Kurt Russell ultimately, Kevin Costner, Jeff Bridges, Bill Pullman. I mean, all sort of make sense. But like if you're looking at the budget of this film, my guess is that they probably got these two guys and Madeline Stowe at a relatively reasonable price. Like they're all kind of mid-tier, you know, actors. But like Ray Liotta at this moment, he's coming off of Goodfellas in 90. Then he's got Article 99 and Unlawful Entry both in 92. And then it's like No Escape, Carina Carina, Operation Dumbo Drop, Turbulence, Copland. Like it just never happens.
Listen, fucking Operation Dumbo Drop. Actually, Carina Carina is pretty good. That's a pretty good little movie. But like obviously it wasn't a hit. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It just it never really happened. And then for Kurt Russell, what's interesting is that like he's coming off of Tango and Cash, Backdraft. We also will talk about Captain Ron from 1992 at some point as well. Another Kurt Russell banger. And then he's got Tombstone, you know, and Stargate, Executive Decision. Like he's kind of, and then he just straight up kind of goes away for a while and then like kind of comes back here and there for Tarantino, basically.
And for the Christmas Chronicles, let's not forget.
Of course, he's Sky High Santa, on the Disney right? Channel.
And Sky High, sure. And like Poseidon, like I'm not saying he doesn't do movies. It's just like, I do feel as though Kurt Russell sort of starts kind of phoning it in a little bit. And he's great in Guardians too. Like he's, I like him. I love him. I don't have a problem with Kurt Russell.
I feel like if you're Kurt Russell and you know, you're married to Goldie Hawn and you have like one of the great Hollywood marriages, and you've made a lot of money and you've been in a lot of great movies and you get into your 40s and you're like, I don't want to work so much. Great. Good for you.
Yeah.
props.
We should all be so lucky.
That man has been acting since he was like nine. Like, yeah, I get it. I'm not saying you're wrong, Phil. I'm saying I get it, Kurt. Thanks for listening.
He was Walt Disney's last words. We have to honor that.
Which is amazing.
What?
You didn't know that, Emily?
I did not.
Casey?
Isn't it that like Walt Disney's final words on his deathbed was it, or that he wrote them down, was just Kurt Russell? Just no sentence to it. He just said it.
Which I think is incredible.
I mean, I just love the image of like Walt in his like Disneyland apartment whipping up a grilled cheese for Kurt Russell and Annette Funicello. You know, that's just the image you want, you know?
It's amazing to me that and no one really knows why.
No.
What if this is like a fucking Being John Malkovich type thing where like when Kurt Russell dies, his last two words will be like, I don't know, they'll be like Angus Jones, the kid from 2 and a Half Men, and people will be like, why? And then Angus Jones will like appear and be like, now I am the one. And you're like, okay,
it's great. Right. I love it so much. It's so bizarre. Well, I mean, and Walt Disney was also frozen after that, wasn't he? Wasn't his head frozen?
Probably. It's in Kurt Russell's freezer. Yeah.
Yeah.
But just imagine your last words being just an actor who at that point had not really done that much.
Yeah, just some kid in some movies you produce. Yeah.
It's incredible. So the director of this film, Jonathan Kaplan, who I think for me anyway, I think the first film of his I probably saw was The Accused. The Jodie Foster, Kelly McGillis sexual assault film, I guess is the only way to describe it, unfortunately. Yeah. It is certainly a product of its time, but still kind of an important movie in its own way of just sort of trying to kind of shine a light on that stuff, even if it's not, you know, particularly effective. Like I Jodie Foster won an Oscar for it. Am I making that up? She did win an Oscar for it. Yeah. And then she would win for Songs of the Lambs like 2 years later. A good movie, but that's kind of the first thing that I sort of associated with Jonathan Kaplan. And then truthfully, like he does stuff over the years, but then he becomes a producing director on ER, which is when he kind of came back into my, you know, cause I'm obsessed with ER.
He has another 1992 movie. This is wild.
A movie called Love Field with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Has an Oscar nomination for that.
He does.
It's the only thing I know of it for.
It's about the JFK assassination. It's about like the Love Field. It's about the like. It's named after the airport or whatever that they land in Dallas or something like that.
He directed Project X.
He did.
Oh my god. This man.
Did you know that you love Jonathan Kaplan, Emily?
He directed Brokedown Palace, which is not a very good movie.
That's right.
I have
that's
seen
a 99.
Like 7 or 8 times. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a bad movie. I mean, have you seen it, Casey?
I have not seen that. The title rings a bell.
It's Claire Danes and Kate Beckinsale and Bill Pullman, and Claire Danes and Kate Beckinsale get locked in a Thai prison, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Midnight, not what's it called? You know what I'm talking about. Not Midnight
Express.
No, that's it. Thank you.
Yeah. It's another movie where Americans are racist about other countries' prisons.
Correct. Completely accurate. Yeah. He also did Bad Girls. You guys ever see Bad Girls?
Mm-mm.
Yes.
Bad Girls was Young Guns, but
how
with girls.
Have I seen so many Jonathan Kaplan movies?
We have your new favorite director, Emily.
Yeah, we stumbled upon it through Unlawful Entry. Bad Girls, I've never seen, but like Madeline Stowe, by the way, coming back for another Kaplan joint from Unlawful Entry. It's Madeline Stowe, Mary Stuart Masterson, Drew Barrymore, and Andy McDowell are cowgirls.
What a 90s lineup there.
I love that this...
You gotta watch Bad Girls, Casey.
That I definitely do.
I love that this man started out making sexy nurse movies. Then he does a hard left turn into blaxploitation. And then it's like, okay, now we're gonna let you direct like Project X.
X has fucked me up as a kid too. Like dead monkeys, dead chimps. It was sad.
Let's just go deep on this guy.
It's pretty crazy.
There's also
I think he
also did this this, like, I don't remember if it's the 70s or the 80s, this film Over the Edge, which I haven't seen, but I've heard about. It's like a cult, like, teen comedy. I don't know. I know the guys from the Pure Cinema podcast are big fans of it. That's the place I've heard of it.
He's an interesting guy who ultimately post ER just, I mean, he's basically just kind of Crossing Jordan, Law and Order, Without a Trace, Brothers and Sisters. Like he's a gun for hire in television and seems to be, you know, I'm sure it's very lucrative, but
he's still directing some SVUs. It looks like, listen, he directed many of John Cougar Mellencamp's music videos. So, let's have him on the pod. Let's bring him on.
By the way, we can get him on the pod. I think that's a safe assumption. I mean, it's one of those guys, and this happens. I'm trying to remember. There was another, Tim Van Patten, who had like a whole swath of television that he directed in 99. And I wanted to see if I could try to get him on as well. You know, they just become journeymen within TV. Now, obviously, Tim Van Patten, a more illustrious TV director, but still, like, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, he directed a bunch of made for TV movies in the mid-90s for cable. Like, I don't know. Love him.
It's a lot. It's an interesting thing. I don't know. I love him. That's the pull quote for this episode.
Like, there was just like this period when like Showtime was like, hey, Jonathan Kaplan, just come and direct something for us. And he would just like, he made a thing that was a 6 short films, each inspired by a different iconic painting for Showtime in 1995. I want to see that. That sounds great.
Yeah. What's this called? So I can write this down.
What is it called?
It's called Picture Windows. It's all directed by prominent filmmakers. Norman Jewison. Okay, here's the other 5 people. Norman Jewison, Peter Bogdanovich, Joe Dante, John Borman, Bob Rifelson, and then Jonathan Kaplan.
That's a kind of murderer's row.
Did not know.
I mean, at the time.
Bogdanovich went to old TV. That's interesting for me.
Yeah, Bogdanovich kind of stopped making movies at a certain point.
Did you know that Peter Bogdanovich directed, this is one of my favorite things. I have to find this because it's such a fucking weird thing. He directed this movie. Oh, God. Okay, here it is. He directed a movie for the ABC's Wonderful World of Disney that is a body swap comedy starring Vivica A. Fox and David Alan Grier as a football player and his wife who swap bodies. That is one of Peter Bogdanovich's films. He directed it for ABC. It is.
Have you seen it?
It screams Peter Bogdanovich, doesn't it?
I was just going to say
that premise and you're like, I can't.
And those actors.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No.
I have not seen it, but I found out about this and after Peter Bogdanovich died, and like, of course, body swap movies are big in the trans community for some reason. So I was like, Peter Bogdanovich directed one of these. You want to watch it? And then we never did. So I said that to all the trans people, and I was like, we're going to set up a screening.
So I'm going to give a little bit of context on Unlawful Entry for the people that that have not seen this film. Happily married Michael, played by Kurt Russell, and Karen Carr, played by Madeline Stowe, call the police after a failed robbery. Officer Pete Davis, played by Ray Liotta, arrives and helps arrange the installation of a new security system. The Grateful Carrs have Pete to dinner and strike up a friendship. Pete invites Mike to ride with him during a night's patrol and gives him the chance to beat up the burglar. Michael refuses and tells the disturbed cop to stay away, but Pete begins stalking the terrified couple. Unlawful Entry opened on June 26th, 1992, against some real heavy hitters here, Emily. Batman Returns, Sister Act, House Sitter, Patriot Games, and of course, The Mighty Ducks.
Hey.
It would go on to make $57 million on a $21 million budget. It has 74% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 49% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars and said, this movie is a thriller with all the usual trappings of a thriller, but the director, Jonathan Kaplan, is able to place the story in a plausible world. The performances go for unrestrained realism. The settings are slice of life, and until the final scenes, even the sicko cop seems somewhere within the realm of possibility. Unlike Basic Instinct, which turned the wattage up so high it was clearly only a thriller, Unlawful Entry has undertones of a serious social drama. We see how defenseless ordinary citizens can be against someone with a delusion. Question for you guys. This movie comes out mere months after the LA riots. I can only assume that this movie probably did better because of that to some degree, right? I mean, a villainous LA cop. Am I crazy?
Yeah, that's, yeah. Even like when we were rewatching it, my boyfriend's like, when does this come out in terms of the riots? Like mid watching it.
Yeah, it just, it feels that way. It's got that energy to it of, I mean, distrust in the LAPD and just sort of, I mean, if I had a nickel for every time I've seen a close-up of the To Serve and Protect, ironically shot in a close-up on the side of a LA police cruiser, it's now relatively common, but it does feel like this might have been one of the first movies. Yes, Emily, you seem to look like the
To Serve and Protect, and I'm just remembering when I would like see that in movies as a kid and be like, yep, they are. For sure, that's true.
I mean,
I had to break myself, everyone. I had to slowly shatter all of my beliefs in the world.
Your
and
preconceived
I
notions
I got of, here.
Of authority.
Thanks to Ray Liotta. Go ahead.
So, Casey, you are new to LA, correct? Relatively new to LA?
Yeah, I moved here like 6 months ago.
Did you fear the LAPD before you moved to Los Angeles? What were your feelings about the LAPD before you moved to Los Angeles?
About the same as every city cops.
Sure.
My boyfriend,
there's a lot of movies about it. That's why I'm.
Oh yeah. My boyfriend had a funny joke. We moved here in September, but back last February we came and visited as like we hadn't been out here before and we'd been planning on moving here. Mm-hmm. One of the first things we see when we're like driving with our friend from the airport is like an LAPD cruiser, and he goes, "Oh my God, the famous LAPD! So familiar with your work."
Yes, their work. I mean, I do think it is interesting that you don't. I mean, the only performance that comes to mind, Emily, and I'm curious if you have one of like good LAPD officer is Magnolia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's no. Like,
I'm thinking,
I mean,
about,
even yeah. Shortcuts isn't like, it's just like every movie that has a cop in LA, they're just a dirtbag.
What's fascinating is this, you know, the other major city that produces film and television in America is New York. And we don't have a similar thing for the NYPD, uh-huh. Even though they're like just as bad. Like there's plenty of, you know, horrible incidents they've been linked to. And yet the NYPD usually like, yeah, people will be like, oh, they're kind of shitty, but they're shitty to help us. Like, you know, like, and New York gets like fucking NYPD blue. And LA gets the shield. Like, I feel like that's like the dichotomy we're working with.
But it's funny too, because like the NYPD blue cops are pretty morally questionable guys.
Yeah. It's very much falling on that line of like, they are bad dudes, but they're on your side.
Yep.
And the shield is also saying that, but it's like putting the emphasis in a different place. So it's like, they're bad dudes and they're on your side. And like, that should terrify you. It's the difference between and but. That's the thing that we learned in today's podcast, folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do think it is interesting that, you know, when I think of New York cops, the only sort of like negative portrayals are like Gotham City cops, which are like faux New York City cops, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
It's ridiculous.
Unlike Chicago,
and even then, like Commissioner Gordon, you know.
Yeah, like Chicago. Yeah. There have been a lot of Chicago cops, mm-hmm. but they're all like their whole reputation is like they're sort of bumbling and ineffectual, and they all talk like this. Like this is so weird. I'm going deep on Commissioner Gordon should be in more things.
I feel like this movie, which had three screenwriters, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite know that this movie needed three writers, but it had them.
I feel like it works perfectly. That there are no like logic
Swiss
gaps
watch.
Or anything in this movie. It sounds like I'm being shitty, and like people have listened to this enough to know that I sometimes get shitty. I kind of love this movie. I had a blast.
I had a great time with this movie, just to be clear. Like I didn't dislike it, but I also feel like it's funny. Like you hated Final Analysis. Understandably. Final Analysis. No good, very bad. Don't bad watch movie. It, Casey. I don't know if you've seen Final Analysis. Have you seen Final Analysis?
I have not. I don't even think I've heard of this film. So that's
Richard Gere, Kim Basinger, Uma Thurman, Eric Roberts.
No. Mm-hmm.
It's like bad Hitchcock. And it's also like, I don't know what that movie's saying about mental health, but none of it's good.
I was like, so while I was going deep on Jonathan Kaplan, I saw there's this other thing that he and Peter Bogdanovich did together called Fallen Angels, which is this neo-noir that ran two seasons. It's a neo-noir anthology made by Showtime, the greatest television network in history. I was like looking through the list of directors. It's like Steven Soderbergh. This is the only time Tom Cruise has directed anything. Alfonso Cuarón, Kiefer Sutherland. Oh. And like there's all these great names. John Dahl. And then the first episode was directed by someone named Phil Juneau. And I was like, why do I know the name Phil Juneau? And I looked up that he did and looked him up and he did Final Analysis. I was like, well, I'm never watching that because I'm not going to get through that first episode.
So the reason I bring up Final Analysis is that I think is the I'm deducing here, but of the thrillers we've done thus far, Emily, I feel like they all demand you to get on their wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can, they're a lot of fun. Right. Because like there's a camp factor and a trash factor and they all kind of feel like kind of B movies with a big budget. But like, so if you come into this movie with that headspace, I think it's kind of fun and trashy, but I don't say that in a derogatory sense, but Casey, I'm curious as to sort of, so you saw this back in film school or in, right?
As so many of us did.
Oh, as yeah, so yeah. many of us did.
I had to bring that story to the table. I had to.
As you should.
Yeah. I think it was the thing of being like, I saw that list and it was like the very bottom list. I was like, Unlawful Entry, a movie that no one remembers that I've seen. Well, I have to. I think it was also the thing of being like, I had to be realistic of being just like, no one's going to pick Unlawful Entry. That's my time. It's like, you know what?
I'll be honest with you. Someone else did pick Unlawful Entry. So you'll be surprised. Don't think that it was at the total bottom of the bio.
Because I know that this was spoken on a podcast I'm a very big fan of that you've both been on. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, Clay Keller, big fan of Unlawful Entry.
Wow. Wow. Well, no, listen, that makes absolute sense.
Doesn't it though? Just, it really does.
I'm like,
But I bring this up just because it's interesting that like, so you saw this in film school, Casey. You watched this, I'm assuming, again the other day before this with your boyfriend. What was it like in terms of just sort of what it was like when you watched it in film school and what it was like watching it now?
I feel like I think I liked it more the second viewing. I feel like I kind of thought of it just as like a random movie that kind of doesn't exist. There was a lot of stuff in it that I didn't remember. I think funny enough, I don't know if it's like when you're not studying film, you end up being more interested in it because like, I feel like I definitely notice like things with the camera and like editing choices a lot more than I did like when I was just studying film history.
It's so a well-shot movie.
There's some weird, interesting shots in this movie that made both me and my boyfriend be like, no, there's something here. Like, this isn't like a boring or like poorly made movie. Like there's like weird choices being made. And I think there was also a lot of the more like, I don't want to say intense stuff. There's nothing that intense, but I think it was the stuff that like I gravitated to in college, I think I picked up on that compared to this time where I was like, you know, found it a lot more like graphic and intense that I was like, oh, this film's like going there more than I remembered it going. There was also just like random plot points. I was like, how did I not remember that?
It gets pretty nasty at the end, for sure. And it goes to some pretty nasty places. Which kind of brings me to the Madeline Stowe character, which I'm curious about your thoughts, both of your thoughts on this, because I do feel like, you know, as is the case with a lot of female sort of lusted for characters in, you know, 90s thrillers, they don't feel like much more than a prize for two men to be fighting over. And I'm not convinced that Karen is all that much more than that. I mean, Madeline Stowe brings something to it just by it being portrayed by her, because I think she's a great actor. But what did you guys think of Karen's character?
I feel like for me personally, like I'm not crazy about Madeline Stowe. She doesn't grab me necessarily as an actor. And I think it's the thing of like, I think you can kind of what we were talking about before, if it had been somebody other than Ray Liotta and it really played into being more of an erotic thriller, I'm like, there is a world where you can read into this movie that she's kind of into it.
Because she definitely seems a little into it.
Because she's leading him on in ways where I'm just like, she's kind of bringing this on herself. And that's another thing I didn't remember. I remembered it as just being Ray Liotta's creepy as fuck. And that was kind of it. And I forgot of this, like them having a little after work drink at a bar and like, you know.
That scene's interesting. Yeah, like, that scene's like, definitely.
That's the thing where I'm like, play more into that. And I think it's also just the thing of, we never kind of get her opinion on everything and her to herself in a way that we do the Kurt Russell character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Emily, what do you think?
I mean, you guys can't
see this, but Emily is shrugging in a very emphatic way.
I want to like Madeline Stowe more than I do. Just like as an act, like I think she's very good. She's been in lots of things where she's very good, but she has like a weird tendency to end up in movies where she's just the woman that like some guys are fighting over, or like, you know, even I really love her in Last of the Mohicans, but I'm not sure she has a character there so much as she has like Michael Mann knows how to like use her screen presence in a very specific way that weirdly Jonathan Kaplan, one of our great directors, did not. I mean, I gotta say, I think there's a way that a movie like this can work where the woman is a bit of a cipher and the men are fighting over her. If you are invited on some level to put yourself in the woman's shoes, especially if you find men attractive in any capacity, or you just like can imagine finding men attractive, like, which is what a fun thing to imagine for all of us.
What a fun thing to think about.
Where you can imagine yourself in that capacity and two men fighting over you if they are giving as compelling performances as the guys are here. It's just something about her that just doesn't do that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't...
She's not blonde. That's what it is. I can only imagine myself as a blonde woman.
She's not blonde. I know what you guys are saying about Madeline Stowe in the sense that... there's something interesting about her. She has a presence that is sort of undeniable to some degree. And yet there's something inscrutable about her as well. And a coldness to a certain degree that makes it hard to really connect with her sometimes. But like, have you seen Shortcuts, Emily, the Robert Altman movie?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it, Casey.
I own the Blu-ray and I still haven't watched it yet, but I'm a big Altman fan. So definitely
you'll love it, and now as a Los Angelino, you will probably enjoy it even more. But she's quite good in that movie because she's kind of playing against type, and she's kind of playing this like messy, crazy kind of housewife trying to raise Tim Robbins' kids, and like there's just kind of this chaotic energy that she's giving off that I quite enjoyed because it doesn't seem like her. And then like 12 Monkeys, I think she's great in, but because it seems like she's understands the movie she's in and has found a way into kind of the madness of Terry Gilliam that I thought was interesting. But yeah. I know what you guys are saying. This is one of those roles that's like doesn't give much to do.
I think it's her voice.
Like, yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh.
No, but I feel like she's there's nothing bad about her. She just doesn't grab me. I think she's probably a lot better with more interesting material or more interesting directors that I think are you know, like Robert Altman can make anybody look good for the most part, you know. Like, he can bring out great things out of actors that are, you know, good enough and can bring out those qualities out of them.
And she's one of, like, 50 people in that ensemble.
Yeah.
Emily, what were you going to say?
She has a voice that doesn't fit who she is. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with this. Like, a lot of people have voices that don't quite fit how they present. I would argue Cate Blanchett's, like, someone who's kind of on that spectrum. But, like, Cate Blanchett makes that voice work for her.
Sure.
And I think that Madeline Stowe, she's so ethereally beautiful. And so she's often chosen to be this sort of angelic figure. And then she has a much like more forceful voice. And so like those kind of things are kind of working at cross purposes. And when a director figures out how to wed them together, like Last of the Mohicans, where she is someone who's like, yes, she's an angelic figure, but she's also like constantly pushing forward, pushing towards something. It really works. But when she's just like supposed to be the figure of fascination for a bunch of different people, it kind of falls flat.
I think that's fair. I mean, especially in this film too, where you do get sort of the feeling, I like the three leads. I think it's interesting that these are the three people in this film. And yet at the same time, there would be times where I'd be watching the film and being like, kind of weird that these are the three people in this movie. Like, yeah.
It's just a strange movie.
It is a strange movie.
Like, there's so many things about it, I'm just like, it's strange that these three people are in it. There's things that happen in it that are strange and told in a strange way. We haven't even gotten to the weird nightclub party at this, like, Grauman's Chinese theater building.
It's like the energy that Kurt and Ray are giving, especially when they're at odds with each other, is so kind of bizarre, because like you get the impression that Kurt on some level is kind of, I don't want to say that he's annoyed, but like he's maybe got the least interesting role in this movie, just in the sense that like he's just not as compelling as Ray Liotta's character is. So like there's a lot of bluster there, and he's trying to like make a meal out of things that maybe aren't necessarily, you know, all that compelling to some degree. Like I was thinking about the end of this film, Emily, and it made me think about Consenting Adults. The third act of this film felt very much like Consenting Adults.
This movie, I was going to say, is also similarly homoerotic. There is a lot of
right?
sexual tension between Liotta and Russell. Yeah.
There really is. And Ray Liotta feels metaphorically and at times even maybe physically impotent. Like there's something about his sexual encounters that are violent, and he's very quick to tell a woman she's worthless and very quick to kind of you know what I mean, like he's clearly fighting urges and doesn't understand what's going on inside himself.
Yeah it's compelling. It is interesting that I really like Russell in this movie. It's not like my favorite Kurt Russell performance, but I think he's quite good. And I think what's good about it is like this movie is in some ways kind of about masculinity. Actually, that's a really like obvious thing to say, but I'm gonna make it less obvious, I promise. it's about this kind of masculinity that assumes constantly that we have everywhere in America now, and in the 90s was ascendant. It's a masculinity that is good at performing, you know, I'm a good, safe guy and I do this, but is constantly terrified that there's like just all these other guys are going to come and pummel you in the face. And I got to protect my wife and my house and my cat Tiny. So like that's what I need to do. It's a very important in a way. Like this movie is kind of about Kurt Russell and Ray Liotta being the same guy, just flipped slightly differently. Mm-hmm. And like Madeline Stowe being sort of drawn to both versions of that guy. Mm-hmm. And it's like they don't have that balance perfectly worked out. If they had, it would be a, like genuinely, I think, a really, really good movie.
Yeah.
I think that there's a line that really stayed with me in that bar scene between Karen and Pete. And it's when he says, you should never feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole thing. Like that's tapping into what you're talking about as well, Emily, this idea of gender roles and this of sort of this idea that men are there to protect women and that they need to feel safe and they need to feel loved and they need to. And it's not to suggest that those things are toxic necessarily, but this movie is taking all of them to a toxic place. Mm-hmm. And I think that manipulation on Pete's front of using his policeman status to give Karen this false sense of security is super fucked up.
Too many white baby boomers had childhoods where they felt perfectly safe and secure outside of like the nuclear bomb drills, and it broke the fucking planet. Like that is what happened.
I mean, there's something to that. I want to talk for a second about, and this is, you know,
Jonathan Kaplan.
No, actually, surprisingly, I was going to talk about Ray Liotta almost being cast as the Joker. he was Tim Burton's second choice had the Nicholson thing not played out. I think he might have been a great Joker.
Especially more so, I think, if having seen Something Wild, because that I definitely feel like is his like Joker performance. Would he have then, would he have done Goodfellas then, you think, if he had done
who knows hard to say what kind of career really Otto would have had if you I mean, would Batman have been Batman without Jack Nicholson is the other thing.
Yeah, that's like, true.
I don't know
that. And because I also feel like it might be the similar thing of him and Keaton might be too
similar
kind of. In a way that like him and Nicholson are completely not.
Right. And so much of the you know, we talked about Batman with Karina Longworth on our 89 Patreon, which will be coming out for everybody for free at some point this year. But I do think that we talked a lot about sort of the Nicholson thing in Batman, you know, for all intents and purposes, kind of the secret sauce and the thing that kind of elevates that film into a completely different echelon. And I would argue breaks it open to boomers in a way that I'm not sure that film would have without him. Like, my parents go and see Batman because Jack Nicholson is in it, right? I don't know that they go and see it because Ray Liotta is in it. So, you know, it's just sort of, but all that being said, he's very good in this. And I did sense a little bit of that menacing Joker kind of energy.
Ray Liotta was still alive in 2019, right?
He was.
Mm-hmm. He should have played the Joaquin Phoenix Joker. He should have been like,
he's in Marriage Story.
That's the fucking thing is like that movie. Like I actually kind of like Joaquin in that movie, but like there's no center to that performance. I don't know. Like Ray Liotta, like just would have had a thing that I think would have worked. I'm like kind of serious about this.
I know you are, but I'm also thinking about what Todd Phillips and Ray Liotta on set would have been like. And I don't know that would have been a safe environment.
No. Yeah. No, that. Yeah. No, listen. Yeah.
But I do think that, I think Kurt's doing some interesting stuff in this film as well with especially kind of this the kind of second act emasculation that's going on, and how he grapples with that, how he sort of deals with, you know, losing his money and losing his power and losing his influence. And I think that stuff's really interesting as well.
Yeah.
And I think also, I think when you were bringing up the line about like feeling safe, I feel like that all comes out too when she finds out he bought the gun, and his reasoning is like, I can't have another man touching you like that.
Yes.
Like, it's never about like, oh, I need to protect us. It's exclusively about the fact that another guy touched her, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, sorry, go ahead, Emily. Sorry.
I've been thinking about this a lot because the upcoming episode of Succession, as we're talking about, I'm not going to spoil it, but the upcoming episode as we're recording this, and this is several months in the past as you're listening to this,
it is.
How are things in the future?
This is coming out in August.
Oh my god.
I was talking with someone about, hey, do you want to come on the pod? And they were like, listen, I don't know if I'm going to have time to record. I was like, it's for an episode in September, so you're fine. I think, but anyway, there's this major theme in this upcoming episode of Succession that's just sort of about this idea of like defeating death by making yourself absolutely secure, absolutely safe, sealing yourself off, that drives so much of like American, especially white American men, but not exclusively white American men, just this like deep-seated, you know, sense of entitlement and, you know, terrifying paranoia, this like, oh, everything needs to be a certain way or I can't be safe. That is honestly just like, in many ways, plays as a reaction to trauma in many ways. And it's just like that this movie taps into that in a way. Actually, it might know. There's this thing in this movie. This movie's trashy as fuck, but it is like it is like talking about like really serious topics in a way that approaches how they're serious and important to talk about that other movies weren't. This movie is one of the most anti-police movies you'll ever see. And it's very forthright about that. And it's because it's trashy, it sort of slips a lot of it under the radar. But like a lot of the reviews at the time were like, this movie's trashy, but it is talking about social issues in a serious way that I found surprising. 3 stars, you know, like,
well, it's, I agree. And I do feel like, I think the LA riots has a little bit to do with that, right? In the sense that I think critics are looking at this film through the prism of what has happened a few months ago in Los Angeles and how this film carries a little bit more power with it than it probably would have had those, you know, riots not happened. But I also think that, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, Emily, and obviously you as well, Casey, but there's a lot of like doppelganger shit going on in 92, especially in these like sexy thrillers. Single White Female, Final Analysis, even Basic Instinct is playing with doppelgangers as well to a certain degree in terms of, you know, Jeannie Triplehorn dressing up like Sharon Stone. Like there's a lot of this like aesthetics and wanting to be other people and all this kind of stuff that I think this film is also dealing with. Cause like Ray Liotta just wants to take over Kurt Russell's life. And I'm curious, do you see anything in that, Emily, by any chance?
I mean, I would love to take over Kurt Russell's life. Like, no, there is this element of like, I do think it is this thing of like, American men are at an inflection point in 1992 in a very, like, this is the year Bill Clinton gets elected, and Bill Clinton gets elected by sort of running away from the sort of Reaganite cowboy thing, but toward a different kind of masculinity, which is like a horny man who likes to eat fast food, which is, I mean, actually it's running away from John Wayne and toward Kevin James. Like that's the twin poles of American masculinity. But it is like it, but at the same, there is, you know, you have movements like the Promise Keepers is this Christian group that is popping up around this time. That's very much like, we are men, it's of God, but emphasis on men. And it's like, there is this thing within American masculinity that is like terrified of this divide between who we feel like we're supposed to be, which is like, you know, strong and able to protect everyone, versus who we actually are, which is weak and vulnerable and unable to protect anyone because no human can protect anybody. And a lot of these movies are like exploring that divide across two guys. And certainly there are movies where the doppelgangers are women, but they're playing into different ideas about, I mean, the fucking Betty and Veronica thing of like, here's what two women can be like. But like,
but Single White Female is also playing into sort of,
well, I mean, Betty and Veronica had the same face. So
have you seen Single White Female, Casey?
I have not, but I'm very familiar with it. At least, you know,
I think you, I don't know.
Everyone knows what it is to single white female someone. It's a verb.
It's a good movie. I liked it. I don't know. It's, I mean, I enjoyed it. But I know what you're saying, Emily. And it's so funny. As you were talking, I was like, it's kind of crazy that Clinton like owned the 90s. I mean, 8 years of the 90s are obviously his administration. So it is sort of interesting how that affected the definition of masculinity in a lot of ways, which I think is, that's its own thing. But
and I'm happy to announce that William Jefferson Clinton is coming on for the Beethoven episode. So he's gonna talk his election, which happened this year, sure. And we're gonna get into that, and then he's gonna be like, well, I'm here to talk Beethoven with you folks.
Don't you think he's the Beethoven of presidents though?
Too big, made a mess, kept coming back for sequels for some reason. Yeah, sure. Yeah, why not?
Lovable. People just kind of want to jowly. I don't know.
Yeah, lovable and jowly. And then when you look back at it, you're like,
Yeah. Yeah. And Hillary's obviously the Charles Grodin of politics.
Incredibly accused of sexual misconduct on several occasions, just like Beethoven.
It's not great. Yeah. I want to kind of, you mentioned something, Casey, I think it was you, or maybe it was Emily, my apologies, but sort of the immediate attraction that Ray Liotta feels towards Madeline Starr. Like the first time he sees her, that look he gives her, I'd just be like, you need to leave. Like, you can't look at people with this. He looks like he wants to devour her. Like it's unsettling from the very beginning.
And yet a different actor, it might have worked. Like, I'm not saying it doesn't work. He is doing what the movie needs. He's doing what gives this movie its juice.
Totally.
But it is very much like this movie with a different cast would play erotically. And this, what I think is fascinating about Unlawful Entry, why I'm so thankful I've seen this movie, is it's taking all of these elements that would play in other contexts in 1992 in a much more straight-laced way. And this movie's like, no, this is fucked up. You should appreciate how fucked up this is.
Yep.
Yeah.
So let's talk for a second about the intruder being black, just for a moment.
Yeah.
I want to think that it was intentional to some degree or another, that there was some sort of a commentary going on with that casting. I'm just not convinced that that's the case. I just think that they were playing with the essentially preconceived notions of people, white people feeling threatened by black people. Like, I don't know that there's, unfortunately, all that much more to it. But when it happened, I was just like, I don't like this. Like, I didn't like the intruder scene for a myriad of reasons. Just, it was just unsettling to watch. There's something very scary about someone obviously busting into your home. There was something sort of just the whole thing was very upsetting. But then on top of it all, you had this racial component to it that just made it even more upsetting. Do you think there's more to it than that? Or do you think it's just 1992, it should be a black guy?
Oh, initially I was like, oh, they're going to be playing, you know, into that type of stereotype. And then they choose to have Ray Liotta's partner be played by a black cop, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But then I think it's also when you get to the scene later when they're on the ride along and he wants him to beat him up, the imagery of that scene is very shocking and also, you know, all too relevant and familiar. So you have to wonder if that's intentional or not.
I mean, I don't know when this movie was actually physically made versus when the Rodney King video came out, but it's hard not to watch Ray Liotta in a police uniform in Los Angeles beating a black man with a billy club. Like, it's just, you're just sort of like, I don't know what to make of this other than that either you happen to weirdly fall into this or you're making commentary. I don't know.
Emily? This, I just sort of looked up when they started filming this because I was curious about that as well. They started filming it like 6 months after the Rodney King beating. So it's very much that footage is playing on the nightly news. Like,
okay, great. I'm glad that at least it, you know,
it's interesting. Yeah, it is interested in that question. It is not as interested in it as it is the question of what it means to be a white man, which is like a lot of movies.
Yep.
I don't know. You know, I think a lot of the social commentary in this movie is intentional and some of it is accidental. And I wish that there had been more accidental commentary on like these stereotypes. You know,
sure,
it's
sure.
I do think it is an interesting choice that his partner, who's kind of the one like unambiguously good man in the movie, is a black guy, and he's played by Roger Mosley, who most people know from I think Magnum PI.
Magnum. Yes.
So yeah, who's a very great actor and is very good in this movie. And I actually, watching this, I'm going to bring up The Shield again. I was surprised like how many moves in The Shield pilot seem like they came from this movie. Obviously, they didn't come from this movie, but like you watch this, it feels like an early version of The Shield pilot in some ways.
You never know.
100%. Yeah.
There's, you know, you mentioned earlier, Casey, that there's a lot of sort of visual flair to this movie. And one of the shots that really stayed with me that kind of feels like it's the movie in a nutshell is after that whole fiasco where he takes him on the ride along and he tries to get him to beat up the guy that broke into his house and all of that. And it's clearly like tipped Michael into a place of feeling very suspicious of Pete's mental health and stability and what have you. He's laying in bed at night and he's awake and you're seeing the police headlights from their car kind of scan across the top, like the shadow of the police car lights from outside on the street kind of go across their bedroom. And it's just a really arresting, great shot that visually feels like the movie in a silent image that is this movie that I really appreciated. Did you sort of, at what point did you feel like Pete was a crazy person? Like, was it really from the very beginning, or?
It wasn't. Maybe that could be, I don't remember how I felt the first time I watched it. I probably, I'm in class half looking at my phone. Like, I don't fully remember, but like, so I'm going into this viewing already knowing that. I think maybe for me, it might be the thing of being a woman and then being like, oh, I don't want to be looked at like that. It could be coming from that place. I think it's also this thing of, I never, even though he's, the protagonist of Goodfellas, I never think of Ray Liotta playing like a good guy.
Yeah, no, that's fair. He's not, this is kind of, and I would argue probably the thing that plagued him in terms of like getting to that next level in his career, which is that like he's a very watchable guy, but there's an energy that he gives off that is kind of unsettling. And had he been able to pull off sort of the first 20 minutes of this movie where he's like good guy and everything's all fine and whatever, that might have opened him up to other things. But I think ultimately that's not really something in his tool belt. But then, it's funny. I recently watched Marriage Story again for a Patreon episode, and he's really good in that movie.
He is good in that. Yeah. That's the really only other good one where like the only difference there is that while like, he's not like a bad guy per se. He is a little like, whoa.
Oh, he's a lot. Yeah. But he is also like, you know that it's for good. Yeah. Right? You know what I mean? Like Ray Liotta's using his...
Let's put it this way. He never plays a normal guy.
That's true. That is true. Absolutely.
And I think it's also his eagerness to help them to go out of his way. And I think that also could just be me, now having a very negative opinion of cops and me being like, I don't buy that.
Sure. Yeah. I think that, it's interesting. It's something you mentioned a minute or so ago about like how as a woman, you wouldn't want to be looked at the way that he looks at Madeline Stowe, which is completely understandable. At the same time, you do get the impression that Madeline Stowe kind of likes it.
Yeah. And I don't think they play into that enough.
Right.
Like it feels like something that either was unintentional or they're not leaning into it hard enough.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I feel as though they don't really know what to do with it. Like they're kind of just dipping their toes in the waters of what.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sort of the failures or the vacuums that exist in her marriage that she's not dealing with, and how her marriage is I don't even really think that her marriage is, or their marriage is, particularly bumpy when we meet them. Mm-mm. But you do get the impression that she there's something missing or something.
Yeah,
I don't know how to sort of articulate
it's the thing of, I don't think they flesh that out enough. I feel like it's implied that they've moved around a bit. There's kind of been up and downs with the money.
Yeah.
And then I'm convinced there is a full plot point of this movie that they cut out. And it's before the ride along when like they're all buddy buddy, he asks them why they don't have kids.
Uh-huh.
And they're just, uh-huh. awkwardly silent. And you're like, okay, because this is a plot point that'll come up again. Like, oh, they, you know, to the point where I convinced myself, I think because around the same time in my class, in that same class, we watched Minority Report, and I convinced myself this movie had the ending that Minority Report does, where it's like flash forwarded a bit and like she's pregnant and they've moved on with their life.
Oh, okay. Right. It doesn't.
It doesn't at all. I convinced myself that happened because I'm like, well, they wouldn't bring that up out of nowhere. No.
That is interesting. I guess I completely forgot that. There is something there, though, mm-hmm. right? There's this notion that I do feel like, and I don't mean this to sound in any way engendered, but that she does feel like she doesn't have Michael's attention. Mm-hmm. I think she feels dismissed by him a lot of the time, and she's used as sort of a pawn when it comes to investors and that kind of stuff. Like, she's a pretty woman to have on his arm. She used to be a waitress at one of his clubs. Like, all that stuff is interesting. There's a color there that I feel like they never fully tap into.
Yeah, I definitely feel like you get hints of that in that party scene.
Yes. Yes.
And of course the like drink date with her and Leota when she kind of talks about her past. But again, I don't think you ever get the Kurt Russell character's side of that story. Mm-hmm. So then therefore it kind of just them as a couple and as a connection outside of them whenever they're in danger kind of feels empty.
Yep. No, absolutely. I just there's sort of this Kurt Russell's character feels very much like, I know better, I'm smarter than you, you know, stay out of my way. Like when at the club and there's that kind of intense moment between Kurt Russell and Ray Liotta, and she's like trying to diffuse it and trying to pull Kurt Russell away, and he's basically like, fuck off, I've got this handled, like go deal with, like there's all that energy and all that kind of that weird crackle and dynamic there really felt like there was that they left money on the table a little bit, like that they didn't fully mine it for everything that it could have been. But yeah, I mean, I think it's the club scene. Well, can we just, let's talk about the club for a second, just in general. The club, I was not going to clubs in 1992. So I
was.
Of course you were.
I was definitely not. So.
All right, we get it.
Casey,
you're
it would
young.
Be so cool if you were going to clubs in 1992.
Mm-hmm. I just don't know if this club is how clubs were back then. Because like this club's pretty fucking lame.
Wait, what year? Can I ask you what year you were born? You don't have to answer that. But
I was born in 96.
So listen, we don't know how fucking reincarnation works. You might have been going to clubs in 1992.
It's true.
You might have been.
It's true. Mm-hmm. I was 16 in 1996. So I was also not going to clubs. But in 92, I was 12. and I did not know anything about clubs. I would argue I still don't. All I know is that this club, I'm just comparing it to like club scenes that we have seen in films from 92 thus far, Emily. And like, the club in Basic Instinct is way better than this club. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, the club in Basic Instinct seems like one of the great places to be.
Fucking rules.
By the way, I'm sorry. I was away for a while. You may have noticed you haven't heard my voice.
Well, the listeners were missing you.
Listeners were missing me. My baby was having some issues, so I went to visit and see what was up. And I picked her up and did a couple things, and then she ripped three enormous farts, and she was a lot better. So that's what
good
happened.
Bit, by the way, we've all been
great,
there.
It's a great bit. I was like, okay, I'm laughing.
That's like the baby thing. It's like, okay, yeah. Are you just crying a lot because you just have to fart? That's how it works.
But yeah, so this club just, and again, this might just be a budget thing. This might just be like a production design thing, but it just didn't have a good energy. It didn't have a good vibe.
Yeah.
I don't know why anyone would want to invest in this club. Do you, the little, oh my God, the diorama that he's showing of like what they can do at this club.
Well, so here's the thing. They don't really talk about this too much in it, but this is like the space that'll become the club. This is just the investor party for the club.
It was weird. But I was like, is this the diorama? Is this the same space? Because it looked like the same space.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the weird thing where it's confused. Just because remember before they have like the weird meeting in there and there's like still theater seats
right
in it with his,
and then like the club, by the way, never comes to fruition. We have no idea of it. Like, it all just completely disappears in the third act.
Well, yeah.
He really doesn't seem like a club. Like, that doesn't seem like what his job should be. Like, are you Kurt Russell? I assume they wanted him to play something kind of entertainment industry adjacent. I think he should have played an agent. I think he would have been great as like, kind of like a, he's like an agent who's not cutthroat enough to like hit that next level. Like, he's just kind of tootling along at like a boutique agency or something. I don't know fucking anything about how agents work.
I was waiting to see how far you'd go with this, Emily.
I have a literary agent, and in the publishing world, everything happens very slowly, and it feels like it all happens when people go out to lunch. Like, in this, like, once, two times a year, the entire publishing industry goes out to lunch and they make deals, and then it's like, good, we figured out all the books that will be published, and one of them
That's
was
not
mine,
how
which
it works
was nice.
In movies and TV.
And in movies and TV, this is far enough along in the future I can talk about this. I was trying to like get a thing done. Mm-hmm. Phil was like, hey, here's a thing. Maybe this could be a thing for you. And I was like, okay, I'll see if I can find someone to help me with this. Being like, we have like 6 weeks for me to work on this. And then Phil was like, we need you to, was like an hour later, Phil was like, you need to get someone fucking right now. It wasn't that at all.
I mean, it was definitely I will get into specifics, but I'll just say that there was a moment over the last 48 hours or so, again, time stamping this, whenever the fuck this comes out, where a job opportunity had presented itself. We'll just say that. And I was like, I'd love to help you get this job. And Emily was like, yeah, we're good. We'll figure this out. And I was like, no, you don't seem to understand. This needs to happen like in less than 24 hours.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay. So then I just was like, I reached out to literally everybody I knew and was like, hey, what's up? And then like 16 people were suddenly like emailing me, and I was like, what the fuck have I done? Yeah. Anyway.
It's exciting. Everything went well. The agency world is interesting. And I don't disagree with you that like there is an Ari Gold-esque version of this character. You know what I mean? Where you give him that kind of like Hollywood bigwig, what have you. I just would have bought it more, because when we first see Kurt Russell and he's got all these like blueprints up, I was like, oh, he's an architect. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, nope, he's a club promoter or something.
It really seems like he stole like a sixth grader's diorama from a science fair and was like, I'm gonna turn this into a club. And everyone
this
was
is
like,
what it will
sure,
look like.
Yeah, why not?
It was insane.
Anyway, the moral of that story is I don't know how agents work, Casey, and it scares me, and I don't know how to make it.
I definitely don't either. If you don't, I really don't.
I'm just like, you know what? I think some of them are like more important than the other ones, maybe. Mm. And I messaged my literary agent, was like, hey, are you licensed to do this? And she was like, I'm licensed to do whatever the fuck I want.
Well, this is the thing you learn very quickly. And Casey, I don't know if you know this, but I worked at UTA, a talent agency out here, for almost 8 years as an assistant. And that's when I was there as an assistant, and I sold Sleepy Hollow as an assistant at UTA. And the thing you learn very quickly about agents is that there's like no rules or anything regulating agents. Like, there's, you can just like get off a bus and be like, I'm going to be an agent, and you get a job in the mailroom, and you just can be an agent. Like, you don't need a license to be an agent. You don't, like, it is, it's a very kind of unfettered business, which is why you see the type of personalities that gravitate towards being agents are people that you know, they can be aggressive people. They can sort of, you know, they understand how to get what they want, I guess, is ultimately.
You should not have told me any of this information. I've enjoyed living in. No, actually, I knew that was true. I knew that was true because I've watched a lot of BoJack Horseman. But now that I know this, Casey, I'm your agent now. I just said it. It's true.
Yay.
But truly, that could be a thing. Like, this is just as plausible as anyone else saying that they're your agent, Casey. Like,
100%.
It's crazy. And you should have an agent, Casey. You sound great. I'm sure your writing is great. And there's no reason why you shouldn't have an agent.
Thank you.
It's Emily St. James. I have so much time.
She has all this time.
So much
time. You are the first client at the Emily St. James agency.
Actually, ESJ is like a really great fucking acronym.
ESJ is actually pretty great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, to get back to unlawful entry, just, you know, very briefly,
this is why I'm on the show. I just talk about whatever I want.
Just derail
pretend
it.
Pretend it's related to the movie.
That is the thing that you and Kenny have in common. Kenny was just an agent of chaos that was just like, how long can I drag this into a non sequitur? I want to talk for a second about one of the scenes that I found quite upsetting, but also like complicated and perhaps interesting. And I'm curious about what you guys think of it, which is the scene with Pete and the, I guess she was a stripper or a hooker, the when they're having sex in his police car. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of this like very kind of, let's just say, strained sex scene. It did not seem pleasurable for him. I can't speak to her. She certainly was, you know, putting on a show, but I do feel like it was an interesting situation because you could tell that they'd done it a couple times before. She referred to them sort of like having a past together. You could tell that she had feelings for him in some way or another, but he was like completely shut off from her. And it was almost sort of like, for lack of a better way of putting it, when a woman wants to be with him sexually, he finds that enticing until afterwards. And then they're like a garbage person that he doesn't want anything to do with, if you know what I'm saying? Because you get that impression later on with Madeline Stowe as well. And it just kind of revealed something about Pete's character that, again, I'm not sure they totally mind, but I thought was interesting.
Well, and then you have the best cutaway ever immediately after. Throws her out of the car, and you have the voiceover for the next scene of him talking to the little kids. With, I don't know, remember the line verbatim. I think it's, "I became a cop to help people."
Yeah. And he's talking
brilliant, dramatic irony. Brilliant. Upped my rating just for that part alone. So I was like, that's what this movie's saying.
Great movie. I think there's a thing this movie understands but hasn't interrogated to the degree it has, which is that when you place women on a pedestal where they are a thing that you have to protect from all people who might come to take them, you are doing the same thing as when you just turn them into a sex object. You're removing their agency. You're just making them a piece of your story. And this movie like kind of comprehends that Ray Liotta's obsession with Karen and keeping her safe and everything is the same thing as the way he treats the other women in the movie. And that Kurt Russell has a little bit of that toxic masculine mind virus inside himself. I just don't know if it's actually like actually interrogated that. I think it has noticed that is happening, but it has not thought about it to the degree that it's thought about some of its interest in police brutality.
I agree. And I, you know, I don't want to read too much into this, but I'm going to because whatever. But like when you have multiple writers, I do feel like what ultimately happens, and I'm sure Emily, in the myriad of movies that you've reviewed, you've seen this as well, where like when you have multiple writers, the movie gets kind of whittled down to moves rather than the kind of nuance. And you know, you start to see the kind of gears a little bit more the more writers that come into a project, or at least the ones that they're willing to tell us about. There's then all sorts of script doctoring that's going on where people don't get credit. I bring this up just because I feel like certainly in the third act of this movie I really started to see like just moves, like just plot mechanics and getting where they wanted to go ultimately. As I mentioned, sort of consenting adults suffers from that in the third act as well, of just sort of being like, you know, privileged white men that are getting put in jail for, you know, getting framed for things they didn't do and like all that kind of shit. That I feel like that's what happens when like the movie wanted to interrogate things, but then they were just like, well, we don't really need to go that far with this. Like, I'm more just like, it felt kind of piecemeal and kind of patchworky.
Yeah. This is also really a period when, like, critics especially are starting to tune into the fact that movies have multiple writers, and sometimes that's because they've had many different people working at cross purposes across drafts. Famously, kind of the breaking point for a lot of critics is a couple years later, the Flintstones movie, which had three credited writers, but there were 35 different people who were considered at one point or another for, like, maybe this person deserves a script credit. And, like, a lot of critics were like, 35 writers. And that, if you want to talk about a movie where it feels like everything is reduced to the plot moves, it's the Flintstones movie, obviously. Yeah.
Great production design.
Another movie that Casey is younger than, which is.
Yeah. That's really great. It doesn't make good me feel for you. Old at all.
Good for you, Casey. Congratulations on being born.
So fucking young. That's great for you. I'm so happy for you.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I have a baby, and I, every day I look at that baby and I'm like, I'm so much older than this baby.
So I want to talk for a second about something I read about this film, which was something that happened a lot around this time, which was Kurt Russell and Madeline Stowe both told the press that they did their own sex scenes. That there were no body doubles. This was back in the day when, you know, we actually had sex scenes in movies, which is, you know, feels like, you know, crazy to think about now. But what's funny about that, funny is the wrong word. What is totally engendered about that is that what it means is a dude showed his butt and a woman got completely naked. Like, it does feel as though the balance is just not there. And when you think about the sex scene that transpires in this film, which is mostly cloaked in shadows and moonlight, and you can't even really see really what's going on. I'm just like, this was the thing that you guys felt you needed to tell everyone you did? Like, this is not...
I mean, she almost shows her full ass. So I do understand why she would be like, that's me.
Sure. Well, and she's topless as well. Like, I mean, and again, like, I'm... It's just, to me, when men say they did their own sex scenes, it's like, okay, you got shirtless and maybe showed your butt. I don't know. It seems a little bit less egregious or less sort of, quite frankly, naked than a woman is when she's doing it.
I wish the sex scene had been between Kurt Russell and Ray Liotta. I just think.
Mm-hmm. I just wish that we had, like, pop flashes of it. Just like that Kurt was thinking about Ray.
Picturing the
part in Election when he's thinking about Tracy when he's fucking his wife.
That movie's the fucking greatest. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, Emily, to your point, Ray Liotta watching them have sex, and for a good, like, 10-15 seconds before turning on his flashlight to let them know that he's in their bedroom watching them have sex, does feel like he wanted to be invited in, right? Mm-hmm. Like that he's just looking for a threesome situation.
I'm just too Midwestern. If I walked in on people having sex, even if I was supposed to be there, even if they had been like, hey, we're going to have a threesome and we want you to be the third person in it, I would walk in and be like, oh my God, I am in the wrong house. I am so sorry.
Yeah. I'd walk in like, oh, excuse me.
Oh my. I am in the wrong place.
Oh my jeepers. I am so sorry, folks. I'm going to leave you some snacks down in the kitchen. You kids keep having your fun.
Amazing. So at this point of the film, we have this terrible fucking frame job of Ray Liotta killing his partner because his partner knows too much at this point, essentially. And
I liked that plot turn. I thought that was good. That was fun.
But the way it's shot is so cool, though.
Which shot? Oh, when he's from
when it's from the POV of the dying partner.
That was cool.
It's like, yeah.
It's more about the logistics of it, which is that I'm no forensic. You know, I don't know much about crime scene detection. But I'm looking at the logistics of this.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking,
there's a few, like, I don't want to CinemaSin this movie, but there's definitely certain things where it's like, you know.
It's like he shoots the guy as he's running away.
Yeah.
So are we led to believe that the guy shot him? He got back up. He then shot. Like, there's just, it doesn't
Well, then it's also the logistics going back a bit of, like, how Ray Liotta is able to, like, freeze all of the credit cards and, like, the boot on the car you get. Because it's like the police can be involved in, like, parking tickets.
Sure.
And then the framing job with the police. I'll also say, I feel like we were kind of talking, I think in like this movie's anti-copness, I feel like you get it a lot too in that scene when they come and investigate the house with the drugs. Because it's like that thing of like, if you didn't do this and they're doing this to your house, this is horrifying.
I completely forgot about that part of the movie when they turn. I think because his house upside
I'm
down.
So anal about mess, and I'm watching that scene just like, oh my god, if that I would just take me in, like I don't care. Like I'm
never come over to my apartment. You're gonna hate it. You're gonna have a terrible time. I agree that like there are various like logical loopholes in a lot of this. But I mean, the way it's shot, the way it's framed, just the sudden surprise of it, that's that Jonathan Kaplan magic. And like, you just,
And the fucking, the chase scene leading up to the kill, that's good. It's like, oh, that's where the budget went.
It's good shit. Yeah.
It is good shit. Speaking of good shit, there's a great shot of Kurt Russell as he's walking into the jail that's on the body cam. Mm-hmm. So like, you get that crazy kind of chaotic, you know, camera angle. Which is fun, which I liked. Here's a question for you, Emily. In another film we watched this year, we had someone call the operator and say, can you cut into that phone call? This is the second time this has happened in... Mm-hmm. Was this a thing in 92?
Listen, as I told you, you can do that. You can do that if you need to. If it's an emergency and you're like... Yes, you can. Genuinely, like if you are like, you know, someone who's in a position to demand that. So if you're a police officer,
a white man in an emergency.
If you're a police officer or a firefighter or the mayor, you know, you can do whatever you want.
There's a moment in Patriot Games, Casey, where Harrison Ford is in his car on a cell phone and he's trying to get in touch with his wife, who is also on a cell phone, but she's a doctor and she's talking to a patient and he can't get through to her phone line. So he calls the operator and says, I need you to break into that phone call. And I'm just like, that's not a thing.
It is.
And then in this, Kurt Russell calls from prison and says, can you break into this phone line? And she's like, no.
I do.
Yeah.
So I do feel like, yes, if you are a CIA analyst like Harrison Ford in Patriot Games.
Yeah, I was about to say, like that could be, you know, a little different than, you know, your prison phone call.
You can do that. Like it is a thing that old school like operators had the power to do. It seems like Kurt Russell in this movie thinks he's on a party line, which is not true.
Yes.
Like all of Los Angeles is not on a party line, though it would be great if we were.
It seemed like he was just like, you need to, and literally the operator's like, no, the phone is off the hook. I can't just magically make the phone ring. Anyway, it's just absurd. It's one of those things where we were at an inflection point, technologically speaking, in 92, where I think that people thought, and by people, I mean Hollywood writers, thought they could get away with just sort of massaging the technology a little bit and no one would be the wiser. That's the impression that I'm getting. But
we think that podcasts like it's 1990X should like convince people it's like that the hot hip new thing to do is get a landline?
Yes.
I had a landline a few years ago. It was fucking great.
I loved it.
I mean, Spectrum is begging me to get a landline. So, you know.
Casey, do it. Get a landline. It's get a landline. So good. You could just make phone calls whenever you want.
And you don't have to worry about phone calls getting dropped. You don't have to worry about reception. You don't have to worry about getting like text messages while you're on the phone.
You could put on so many lists, and that's bad, but.
You get so many phone calls from. But anyway, I really like the scene. Speaking of the jail stuff, I really like the scene where Ray Liotta, when he's in the jail cell and Ray Liotta's outside and he's kind of taunting him. Like, you can tell that Ray Liotta's having fun playing such a like mustache twirling villain.
Oh, yeah.
I enjoyed that. Here's a question for you guys. Penny's corpse.
One of the many shocking things in this movie. I think it's you don't expect that.
You don't expect that.
You don't. Like, I forgot that. And I'm like, how did I forget that?
I'm like,
Tiny's
just laying underneath this body.
I'm like, how did I forget a cat? I remember every cat in a movie. And this is, you know, this is right after seeing the great Kelly Reichardt showing up in a theater, one of the best
great movie cats.
Ricky, you're bad. My boyfriend and I keep walking around the house going, Ricky, you're bad.
That movie is the best. Everyone should go and see it showing up. Also, that bird, that pigeon.
Yeah. Good pigeon, good cat.
Good pigeon, good cat. But yeah, so to your point, Emily, Tiny's just sitting in this front sort of closet. Also, that closet did not look big enough to have Penny jammed into the top of that sort of, but I mean, whatever. But
I'm just like, I'm imagining when it gets to be like January 15th and I'm trying to shove my Christmas tree somewhere. It's just like Ray Liotta with like, shoving this woman's corpse up and like, oh, why do they have all these wigs up here? I don't know what that voice was.
I feel like this is when the movie kind of tipped for me a little bit, when basically once Kurt Russell goes to jail, the back half of this film feels a little sweaty to me, where you're just like, so he can't come in the house because the alarm is on. So he needs to he buys groceries and convinces Penny to let him leave the groceries outside the house. So then Penny goes and gets the groceries, and then he attacks Penny and kills her so that he can make dinner for, it's just all just kind of like, what?
Well, and then also, we haven't even brought up the lawyer. We haven't even brought up.
The lawyer's the best, because the lawyer just seems way over his skis the entire time.
Oh my God.
The lawyer's in a different movie, and I always love when that happens. He's in a movie that's about him, where he's like, oh, fuck, I'm so not prepared for this. He's in like a Coen Brothers movie.
I was literally just going to say, he is from a Coen Brothers movie. He's in A Serious Man, and something's happening, or even like, yeah, it's just, so he's amazing. But yeah, so the lawyer basically like mortgages his fucking house in order to get the money to get Kurt Russell out of jail. Then Kurt Russell basically like drives his car, and then when the cops are going to pull over the car, he jumps out of the car. So the lawyer is the one that's actually arrested. This lawyer must really love Kurt Russell, because he's thrown away his entire life for this guy.
Yeah. I mean, maybe
that's the love story. Is that the love story?
That might be the love.
Yeah, I mean, and then you get this whole like, oh, okay. Two questions for you guys. The first, was there a time when passwords were a thing for your home alarm systems, where you had like a word?
I feel like I've seen this in other movies, so it must have been. Or other TV shows or something. Like you have to call. Yeah, no, wait. I had a relative who had one of these home security systems, and they had I never saw this happen. They were like, yeah, if it goes off for too long, then I'm going to have to call a phone number and assure them it was me. I don't know if that was necessarily a password situation, but probably it was.
Okay.
Also, you know, if someone other than my parents was going to come pick me up at the pool, they had to say the word pancakes. And if they didn't, I'd run away.
Really?
Yeah. That actually never worked.
It's, was that your, like, safe word? Pancakes?
My It was the thing, you know, where it was Stranger Danger in the 80s. You won't remember this, Casey, but in the 80s, there was some Stranger Danger. And so it was like, okay, well, we should have a word that we can say so that when people come to get you, you will know that they're safe. And I was like, okay, my word is pancakes. And a couple days later, my grandmother came to pick me up from the pool. And I was like, what's the word? And she was like, what are you talking about? And I would not get in the car with her, because I was like, you have not been sent by the proper authorities.
Oh, I like that.
And then my mom was like, you don't have to have your grandmother say the word. Anyway.
This brings me to my second question for you guys. What do you think this pyramid symbolizes for the writers and or director of this movie?
It's called This Is Going to Be I wish this was the murder weapon, because it's supposed to be, right? She like barely bonks him with it just to get out the door.
But it is brought up so often. It's their password. We see shots of it so many times throughout the film. It must mean something to these people, to the writer and directors. It's got to be a metaphor for something. It's got to symbolize something for these people. Otherwise, like,
I mean, it's a triangle. There's three of them. The points. I don't know. Like,
I mean,
sure,
yeah.
Sure.
That's good. That's good. I think it symbolizes that Kurt Russell's in the Illuminati. And the club is actually a meeting place for the Illuminati where they will decide what happens in the world affairs. So
is this your sequel, Unlawful Entries? Is that what you're unlawful, are you with a dollar sign?
Unlawful Entries is about the Illuminati, yes, which is the natural place you expect this story to go.
I mean, would watch.
When they announce, because this is now a Disney property, when they announce this at like Disney Day, when Bob Iger's back now, right? Yeah. When Bob Iger's like, you've been crying out for it, so we're doing it. Unlawful Entries. People are going to be like, whoa, I wonder where that story's going to go.
Are you sure this is a Disney movie? It's Fox. You're right. Yeah, it's Disney.
It's time for Unlawful Entries, which is a movie about the Illuminati and how they've made an unlawful entry into all of our lives.
Parts of the Disney family. He'll be back.
Did you know that Jaimin Hooson was in this movie?
Yes, Emily? Yes. I forgot about that. Yeah.
I don't think I noticed that.
When Kurt Russell gets arrested and he's waiting for his phone call to be questioned, they're like, you know, you have now to like, you know, offer a plea bargain or whatever, confess up. He's like, I won't talk without my lawyer. And the guy next to him kind of like chuckles at it. That's Jaimin Hunsu.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah.
When Walt Disney wrote the words Kurt Russell as his final words, he was having
he wrote them, he said them.
He was having a vision of he just saw, oh, this young man is going to become a staple of the Disney Empire, and then he will go off and find his own way. And then he will come back to us in the film Unlawful Entry, except that will be a Fox film, but it will actually be a Disney film. And when we make Unlawful Entries, the boy will have become an old man and will return.
Foresee Unlawful Entries on Disney Plus.
Yeah. And then people are like, what's Disney Plus? He's like, it is where I go after I die.
Can I just say that the poster for this movie is kind of great?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Emily, of the poster of this movie?
What if the like cryogenic chamber where Disney's frozen is was called Disney Plus? Like, what if that's what they got the name?
Our listeners can't see this, but there are moments where there's a glint in Emily's eye, and you know she is not going to go where you want her to go.
I have had the weirdest like 72 hours of my life, and my mom is here, so I'm just like, what is happening?
I'm
just thinking about Disney's corpse. Please ask me the question you were trying to ask me.
I'm delighted, so this is great for me.
Yeah, as an Emily fan, you're getting everything you could possibly want. Mm-hmm. this is the pure Emily, the uncut.
And I really enjoyed this movie. I was like, I'm excited to talk about the movie. And then I sat down and I was like, let's talk about the Illuminati. And I don't understand how agents work.
The poster for this film, for our listeners, is a black...
It's good. Yeah.
It's a good poster. It's a black and white shot of Kurt Russell and Madeline Stowe. He's got a gun. She's cowering behind him. But there's these... It's a big shot over them of Ray Liotta through what look like blinds, sort of slits of blinds and what have you. But it's like, it's a good poster. It's a poster that weirdly I kind of remembered. You know, as our listeners know, I worked in video stores for many years, and like, you remember posters and box art and that kind of stuff. And this is just one of them that I remember. I'd never seen the film, but I remember this, this poster for what that's worth. But so Casey, is there anything else you wanted to say about Unlawful Entry before we rate this movie?
I'm trying to think. I don't think we talked about Tiny the Cat enough.
Tiny the Cat's great.
Tiny's great. I like when they're like doing the raid on the house and you just hear Tiny like run down the stairs. Well,
this actually is a good question, and I don't know if you'll be able to answer this off the dome. I don't know if you will either, Emily. Favorite cat in a movie?
I can answer this off the dome because over breakfast yesterday morning, my boyfriend and I are like, what's the best movie cat? And he read off to me two different like internet lists of movie cats. Who did I say was the best one? I mean, Inside Llewyn Davis is pretty good.
Great cat. I was just going to say. Great cat.
Great cat. Showing Up's up there because Ricky's a vocal cat. Ricky's an inciting incident cat.
It's true. You don't have the plot of Showing Up without Ricky, really.
No.
Emily, do you have thoughts of Cats that jump
I have two standard answers. There's the cat in The Long Goodbye. That is another cat where like the story doesn't happen without that cat, and it's in a totally cat way, which is just like, oh fuck, I need to go buy my cat food, and then the story happens because of that. So like the cat is not doing anything but being a cat, but like, yeah. And Jonesy in Alien is a really great you know, cat.
And these are all orange cats.
Yeah.
That's my wife and I have a joke that one of our cats believes that orange cats are the bravest cats. And like movies, you know, kind of set that up to be true.
It's so friend of the pod, Jordan Gustafson, who you know, Emily, you've been on his pod. He has an orange cat named Lewin. Yeah, I mean, orange cats are they not, again, I don't know much about cats. You guys know more about cats than I do. Orange cats are notoriously a little bit crazier, quote unquote. Like they're a little.
A big thing going around on, I follow a lot of cats on Instagram and Twitter. A big thing right now is orange cat behavior is a term. It's like people with orange cats have, so, you know, videos of them kind of going crazy and be like.
Sure. I've always wanted an orange cat. Yeah. I've always wanted an orange cat.
Why didn't you get one? You have two cats.
I have three cats. At one point in my life, had five cats, and they're very slowly.
At one point, my parents had seven cats.
Okay. That's too many cats, guys.
It's they were indoor, outdoor. We had a big land. It was fine.
The thing is that cats, the thing is, well, yeah. I grew up on a farm, so we would have like dozens of cats just kind of that loosely lived there. The thing about cats is like children, they like trick your brain into thinking you need more of them. So like you have to tell your brain, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this again. Phil, are you a cat person or a dog person?
You know, I used to be just all in on dogs. Mm-hmm. And then one of my exes had two cats and I was like, you know what? I think I'm kind of into cats now. And I've toyed with the idea of getting a cat because they're also like just not as high maintenance. You don't have to, you know, do as much as.
Do you want one? I have three. I'll just bring you one.
I'm good for now. I'm thinking about it, but it is interesting because Ashley Lyle, they have a person, a friend of theirs that's living with them. Long story short, they had like seven kittens that they rescued from an alley.
Hell yeah.
So they were just like, they had all of these kittens in the house and they were trying to get rid of all of them. And then obviously obviously Ashley kept one of them. So they now have three cats and two dogs. That's a lot of animals.
I had a friend who did that during the pandemic. She like found a bunch of kittens that would have been abandoned by their mother and she like raised them and then gave them all away. And it was like her pandemic project. And it was like really beautiful to see.
That's
and
a nice
honestly,
thing. Yeah.
Honestly, Jonathan Kaplan should make a movie about it. I'm going to go grab one of my cats who's just sitting here. Yeah, you keep talking.
You should.
Please do.
Oh my God. Bring the cats, guys. Bring the cats onto the pod. Do you have a cat, Casey?
I don't. My parents have three cats. My boyfriend's parents have two cats. We always were like, because we lived kind of relatively close to our families back in Philly. So we were like, oh, we don't want to replace them. We'll wait till we move. We're still trying to figure it out, like apartment wise of like, you know, and we also, if we got a cat, we would get two of them, then we'd be done with it. So,
because right, they need friends.
Yeah.
You can't just have one cat.
But, oh my. The black and white cat. I love a mushy black and white cat.
What is this cat's name? Oh, can't hear you. You're on mute.
This is Sally. She's one of two cats we got. And we went to a
miserable.
She's so sad right now. She hates this so much. This is like my baby likes being on the pod more than the cats do. We went to a pet store on a Saturday night to get shampoo for a different one of our cats. And the cashier was holding two 10-day-old kittens. Didn't have their eyes open yet. And she was like, if somebody doesn't take these kittens in, we will, they'll have to be put down. Cause it's just, there are no shelters that are equipped to handle these kind of kittens this time of night on a weekend. It's in Lakewood, California, a barber's place. So I was like, well, you know what? When I was a kid, I saw my mom bottle feed a kitten one time. I think I got this. We got this. We're going to do this. And then my wife, you know, spent every 4 hours bottle feeding these two kittens. And I think I did it once. Once we had a baby, I was much better about taking feedings.
So wait, you took both of the kittens in that
moment? We took both. Her brother is in the other room with the baby. But Sally hangs out in here with me. She is the largest cat in the world. She's so fat. And she's
if,
so
if our listeners, Sally is barely on camera right now. She her eyes were really all that we could see for her. She seems pretty miserable, although now she's sniffing the mic and seemed somewhat just seems disinterested in this.
She's really
situation.
Like she's really heavy. It's really hard to lift her. But you know what? This is what I do for the magic of podcasting.
It's amazing.
Listeners who aren't watching, there's a cat here. That's
there's
what's
a
happening.
Cat, and she's very pretty. She's a very pretty girl.
You might hear her in my mic. She's growling.
Yeah, she's growling. I guess it seems like you guys nailed it with Inside Llewyn Davis. What was the second one that you mentioned, Casey?
Showing up.
Showing up,
of course,
is good.
Sure. Ricky.
Long goodbye, and
Jonesy is a great call.
Sally, of course, all time great movie cat.
I would argue that the cat in Captain Marvel is a standout in not so great movie. Goose.
Yeah, I actually. Yeah. Yeah. I don't even like that movie that much. I have a bunch of merch from it for some reason because it had the misfortune of coming out when I was about to come out publicly. So I was like, I got to get in on Captain Marvel. But I do have which
we can't really see it. Madeline Stowe seems to be getting in the way.
I got to turn off Madeline Stowe. There we go.
There we go. Yeah, everyone, it's Goose the Cat, everyone's favorite company, Funko. They've done nothing bad.
I literally have two Funko Pops, and one is Goose the Cat, and I don't know why. The other one is Spider Gwen, who I have a great deal of affection for, and like I want Spider Gwen merch. And then I have this cat, I guess, because I like cats.
I think that there was a time when everyone was like, you know what Phil would like for the holidays and his birthday?
Yes.
Funko Pops. And I have so many of them that are not on camera right now, but I have 12 of them sitting on my bookshelf.
Yeah, mine did not make the move. They were in the, we'll have mom send them out. We'll get to that. And I'm like, they're not on the priorities. Although I have a good like limited edition one of the Grady sisters from The Shining still in the box. That's cool. That one's cool.
I have all the sisters from Orphan Black. So I have all four of them, which is, you know, whatever. It is what it is.
I got a limited edition of Hannibal Lecter covered in blood from the TV show. I got at Comic-Con. That's somewhere.
I have the what the fuck is the Wendigo, the black thing.
Oh,
yeah. Whatever. I have that Funko.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
The thing that I think is, I have so many of these things, and like Libby and I didn't actually want them. We just kept getting them. They just kept showing up because what it was to be a pop culture fan between the years of 2012 and 2017. I feel like those are the boundaries.
Sure.
And like, we constantly think about, well, what if we just threw them out? You know, what if we just left them somewhere? And then I'm like, my brain kicks into high gear and is like, well, that is the most IP you can put in a movie ever. These Funko Pops get lost in an alley and they have to find their way back. It's the Funko movie coming this summer from Warner Brothers, Disney, whoever wants.
At some point.
It's got to, listen, let me write it, Hollywood. I know how agents work now, so we can make it happen. It'll be so crass. It'll have so much IP. It'll be so bad, but you know, it'll make a lot of money. So let's
do this.
It will make
a lot of money is the sad, sad reality. So let's rate this movie. I did not see this film in 92, as I mentioned, before this podcast, I was at a 70. I think I'm going to stick at a 70. I feel pretty good about that. I think maybe it's a touch high, but ultimately I think that I enjoyed this movie. I liked the kind of genre that it existed in. It was one of the better thrillers that we've done thus far. So I dug it. I'm going to say it a 70. Where are you, Emily?
You know, I didn't see this in 1992, but I read the premise, thought it was groundbreaking, and gave it a 99 based on that alone. The queerphobia scale, I mean, I'm going to give this a 5. You just know Ray Liotta's like beaten up some queer people in his time.
Absolutely. Also, even though he's not dealing with his own potential
sexuality. Also, like, the thing is, this movie had so much potential for homoeroticism and kind of skewed away from it too many times for this to even be like a camp classic. So, but I think the movie itself, I enjoyed. I think I'm going to give it a 67. You know, I think it's, I think it is a little too trashy to be as good as it could be, but it's, you know, it's got something in there. Something's cooking in there that I think is really interesting. It's got that Kaplan magic, you know, the famous.
Casey, I'm curious to hear what you would have rated this in film school and now what you would rate it.
I feel like at the time I probably was at like a 57. And then prior to this podcast, I think I was at like a 64, but I think we're going to go up to a 67. I think this conversation made me think a little bit more, made me like it a bit more.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
I think it's a good movie. I would tell people to watch it. I think.
Yeah. Like if they showed this at the New Bev in a double bill, I would be like, yeah.
Yeah. If they showed this. Yeah. With Wild Things, which I think is a movie that's kind of trying to do what this movie's doing and doing it better. But like, I would be, you know, I think they're both kind of disreputable and trashy and like brushing up against stuff they don't know how to deal with. But Wild Things is like more aware of what it's doing tonally. Do you remember that like video that was like about Spielberg face? It was about like the people like staring up in awe. Do you think I could make something called Kaplan face and pull it off? You think I could be like the films of Jonathan Kaplan?
Are you gonna, you should do one of those books that they've been doing, you know, those coffee table books on filmmakers, you know, Catherine Hahn did one on, or sorry, Karen Hahn did one on Bong, and, you know, you should do one on Jonathan Kaplan. I think it would sell a lot.
I think it would sell so much. Considering, like, the last time I tried to sell a nonfiction book, which granted was in 2020, it was about the TV show Lost, and people were like, I don't know if anyone would want to read this. I think that people would buy my Jonathan Kaplan book. It's the conclusion I have.
People would absolutely buy your Jonathan Kaplan book.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No? Can you imagine if I just like, what if I just put my Twitter bio right now, Kaplan on Kaplan, arriving from Three Rivers Press 2026.
That'd be incredible. So I don't know if you've seen the movie that we're covering next week, Casey, but I'm curious. And Emily, I'm sure you don't even know that we're covering this, but it's going
to
be great.
I'm so excited to find out what it is.
We're covering Honeymoon in Vegas with Hunter Covington and Stacey Traub. Emily, I don't know.
Nothing. I'm excited to watch this. I watched it in 92. I liked it.
Is this the other movie you saw in theaters?
No, of course not. The other movie I saw in theaters is a movie that will simultaneously make you go, you saw that? And, oh, that makes sense. You saw that. It's not Honeymoon in Vegas.
Have you seen Honeymoon in Vegas, Casey?
I have not. I feel like early 90s is my big blind spot for whatever reason. I think because I was such a big, like, classic film fan and, like, 70s film fan, and then, like, everything, like, late 90s onward, that like early 90s is,
I know what you're saying,
it's like when you announced you're doing 92 and then promptly were like, you know, sending out flyers like, oh, here, you want to be on the podcast, and I looked at my own list of what I'd see in 92 and I was like,
it's a weird time, and I think there's a specific reason for that, which I think Emily and I have talked about a little bit, which is that I feel like 93 onward is the 90s that we know and possibly love, you know, Jurassic Park and kind of that. It felt like from that point on, these type of movies, and by these type of movies, I mean thrillers and adult movies and what have you, that existed kind of in the, you know, 70s, 80s and what have you, started to fall into favor. They took a lot of swings with a lot of, you know, Joe Esterhaz movies that were expensive and then ultimately were like, we don't need to do this anymore. So it is, I think, that pocket of like 90, 91, 92 feels almost like a different decade. Would you agree, Emily?
You've said this argument a few times, and I agree with it. I don't disagree with it. But now that I know that Fast 11 is called Fast 10 Part 2, I feel like 1992.
It's not.
I think it is. I think like I saw that. If I'm wrong about that, no one edited it out because it's great. It's great. I feel like 1992 should be 1989 Part 3. So
it actually kind
part
of
four.
Is.
part four, because 90 is, yeah, it is. It is.
It is. It is. Part four. There's something very weird. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this year, because it does feel like a bit of a fulcrum point. And as Emily knows, I'm obsessed with this decade. But I just feel like it's an interesting moment. But you're not alone, that I think, certainly generationally, I would assume that your generation, a younger generation, is probably cherry picking deeper in the 90s rather than earlier in the 90s.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of universal. I think the first half of whatever decade you're born in is the like a time when you just don't see a lot of the movies. Mm-hmm. Like I still haven't seen most of the movies from the early 80s. Like I've seen obviously like E.T. and fucking, you know, titans of cinema. But you know, if there are movies, like I've never seen On Golden Pond, you know, maybe I should. Maybe I'd love it. Who knows?
I don't think you would.
Kind let's watch it. Let's just
On Golden
let's
Pond?
Just toss it in. Let's just throw it in the mix.
Can you imagine if the first movie that we watched together, Emily, because we've never watched a movie together, was On Gold. We've gone to the movies a couple times, but I just mean like times, yeah. in your home or in my home, we're like On Golden Pond feels like the first one that we should just pop in the VCR.
Just throw on Golden Casey.
Honeymoon in Vegas, though, for people that don't know, I'm assuming Casey, you might be one of them, is a quite a fun kind of. It's almost a comedy version of Indecent Proposal is really kind of what it is. Nicolas Cage.
I'm excited.
Nicolas Cage, Sarah Jessica Parker, James Caan go to Vegas to get married. And James Caan is like a mobster who tries to steal Nicolas Cage's wife.
I like that you said all three of them went to Vegas to get married. And yeah. I was like, exciting. This is spicy.
Well, yeah. I remember Nicolas Cage in dressing up like Elvis. But anyway, yeah.
I was obsessed with Sarah Jessica Parker. I just like, you know, blonde girl, my kind of deal. This is also like Nicolas Cage made a trio of like light comedies at this point in time.
It's a weird moment, actually, now that I think about it, because I'm going to look it up really quickly here, because you make a good point where he's sort of doing these like playful movies because he doesn't want to be, I don't know, pigeonholed is kind of like dark and angsty, but it's also like post Wild at Heart, if I'm not mistaken. So like he's just in a really interesting space. It's like I think Guarding Tess was around this period too.
Dude, does he have other 92 movies? We should have Keith Phipps on to talk Age of Cage or whatever.
We should have who on for it? Sorry.
Keith Phipps of the AV Club.
Absolutely.
He has a book about Nicolas Cage, really good. So.
Does he really?
Yeah.
In 92, he only has Honeymoon in Vegas. But just to give you a sense of where he is, Wild at Heart, Honeymoon in Vegas, Amos and Andrew, Red Rock West, Guarding Tess, It Could Happen to You, Trapped in Paradise. He was in a real fallow period. Until
he was
making
whatever. Yeah.
He was making whatever. And then
he's great in Wild at Heart. So.
I mean, Wild at Heart, obviously.
I really like It Could Happen to You. I think that is a sweet, nice rom-com.
I like that movie, too. I don't think that any of these movies are bad, but they definitely feel like I don't know where I fit in Hollywood.
I've never seen Amos and Andrew, but I'm pretty sure it's bad. Like, I'm just going to...
Yes, yes, I would agree with you. I just feel like, obviously, Leaving Las Vegas is the moment, you know? Yeah. Obviously, wins the Oscar. And then from that point on, it's like he kind of can do whatever he wants, and he does for a while there.
Can I tell you a story about some kids?
Is it about City of Angels?
No, it's not.
Okay.
I once made out to the Goo Goo Dolls song from that movie. That's my story about City of Angels.
Cyrus?
Yeah.
That got a thumbs up for our listeners from Casey.
I went to see the film Beau Is Afraid the other night at the Alamo Drafthouse in Los Angeles. And because I have a baby, I only go see movies after the baby's asleep. So I saw a 9:30 PM showing of a 3-hour film, which 20 minutes of trailers. I got out of there close to one. I'm leaving. There's this group of like where I live kind of by USC. So like all these film students come up and see movies in my local movie theater. And so there's this group of appear to be film students standing in front of the Beau Is Afraid. Like there's a big like banner that they have. And they're like, hey, will you take our picture with this banner? And I was like, sure. And then the guy who hands me his phone to take the picture is like, that movie was amazing. And then there was a beat and he said, it was way too long. And then there was a beat and he said, it can be both apparently. And then I went and took their photo. And As I left, I was walking away, and this same guy says to his compatriots, "Yo, is that guy famous?" And one of the girls said, "That's Nicolas Cage." And that's when I realized he was pointing at a Renfield poster.
Oh my God. Did anyone see Renfield?
No.
Yeah,
I only see one movie a week because I have a baby.
So. I thought Bo was afraid at a 1 p.m. matinee because that's when I see movies.
Did you have, were there other people there? Did they have a good time?
There were. I don't know if they had a good time. I had a good time. I mean, I felt bad and it reminded me of my nightmares, but that's, you know.
I was sitting between two couples at date night and I was like, that was so fun. It was so fun to sit there. It's like the women like would politely laugh and the guys got more uncomfortable. I loved it. It was great.
I don't see myself seeing that movie.
If you're a person with anxiety, I feel like
I'm a person with anxiety that was triggered by Schenectady, New York. So I think
My boyfriend he really liked it. We both were like, well, we're definitely in the camp of liking it. He was like, as somebody with anxiety and guilt feelings about my mother, I had a very hard time.
Yeah, it's like I don't need Jewish guilt about my mother for over 3 hours.
But. No,
I think Ari Aster is just so dialed into whatever the fuck is wrong in my brain that like every movie he makes, I'm just like, why should I be more concerned that I find these movies intensely relatable? Like maybe, I don't know.
You loved Midsommar, right?
Midsommar is one of my favorite movies ever made. Like genuinely, like it is to me a deeply profound and meaningful film that I can't wait to talk about on the pod when we do podcasts like it's 2019.
I mean, I definitely will watch it. It's a movie that it's the one that I am most interested in watching. Let's put it that way. The other two, I'm just like, that's.
I think you would like it. It has definitely got some moments in it that might make you go, but it's not as scary as its reputation. Then again, I say that as like a huge horror fan. So
yeah, I need to rewatch Midsommar. I only saw it the one time in the theater and I loved Hereditary. And so I think that I went into it with a certain expectation. I like horror and I like fucked up gross stuff. So like, you know.
Yeah. And Hereditary is
fucked
up gross stuff.
Have you both seen Evil Dead Rise?
Mm-mm.
I need to.
I'm weird about horror in the theater. I think because I fell in love with horror watching stuff at home when I'm in a theater, like the anxiety is like too much. Like I'm like, I can barely watch it. I'm like watching it through my hands. And it's like,
yeah, you're trapped with it, which I don't love.
Yeah. Like, I like being on my couch watching horror. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or,
as a big baby, it's just not my thing.
Or like Midsommar. Some of it was just like, I think there's a really cool trans reading of that film that the critic Emily St. James has advanced. Also, I went and saw Hereditary with my wife and she was like, I don't know if this guy's talking about mental illness that well. And I was like, fuck, she's got a point. And then I went and saw Midsommar with her and she like laughed her head off through the whole thing. And she was like, oh, OK, he totally knows what he's doing. It's fine. It's fine. So, yeah, that's she refuses to see Bo is Afraid because I told her I don't think you should see that movie. So.
Well, this was great. We went over 2 hours on Unlawful Entry, Emily. So
I'm sorry, Casey. This is just how it is now. This is who I am.
No, I'm thrilled. This was a dream for me.
You have nothing to apologize for, Emily.
Can I tell you, I've had this pulled up for a while and haven't gotten to say that Ray Liotta was nominated for Best Villain at the MTV Movie Awards. Here's the other four nominees. This is all of these.
I know the winner, but I don't know who the nominees are.
The nominees are Jennifer Jason Leigh, single white female, Danny DeVito, Batman Returns, Jack Nicholson, A Few Good Men, Sharon Stone, Basic Instinct. Like Ray Liotta's up with those four. The winner was Jennifer Jason Leigh, which I think is a great choice.
Which is surprising, actually, because I kind of would have expected Sharon Stone to win that, considering how like
she won two other categories. So I'm guessing that the MTV Movie Award voters were spreading the wealth around a little bit.
The wealth around.
Yeah.
The Danny DeVito thing is interesting. Mm-hmm. And also no Michelle Pfeiffer for Batman Returns.
I'm guessing that like at that point in time, it was a lot more popular to sort of be like, oh, maybe she's like the, you know, kind of the protagonist as well. I think that Penguin is a little bit more outwardly villainous. Maybe. I don't know.
I take umbrage with that. I like that Ray Liotta got this nomination though, just to be clear. Yeah. Like it's as David Sim said, hard to get into the five. And he did.
I think his character should also have been named Oswald Cobblepot though. Anyway.
can you imagine?
I don't think Ray Liotta could even like say that. Like I think that would just come out as like
no. incredible.
But Aaron, listen, I can take care of you. I'm Oswald Cobblepot.
Casey, we hope you'll come back and talk with us about something else in the future.
I would love to. I would love.
I'll bring one of my other cats. That'll be what we do.
It'll be great. You'll come on. We'll talk about something else from a year you were not alive for. And it'll be wonderful.
Where can the people find you? Do you have anything you want to plug at all?
Nothing to plug yet. If I say this in writing now, then it'll have to come true. Ideally, by the end of the year, I'm looking to start a YouTube channel to talk about physical media and also dive into like director filmographies and stuff. The idea of like, you know, looking into what types of stuff I like watching on YouTube and being like, oh, I don't see somebody doing this, so why don't I do that? Haven't worked on it yet, so you know, progress there. But in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Casey Lee Clark. And yeah, if I do anything, I guess you'll find it there.
I'm following you on all those platforms as we speak.
Everyone should be following Casey. She is, her tweets are great. Her posts are great. And I have no doubt that her YouTube channel will also be great. For all we know, it is happening as we speak.
Yeah, luckily this is far enough in advance where I'm like, might be happening.
It's possible. Because
that's the month of my birthday you said this coming out. And I'm like, that's definitely a goal time.
There you go. That's a great place to be.
I love we record so far in advance. I don't know what my life looks like at any point. In August, I probably have like 6 more kids. Who knows?
And 7 more cats.
Yeah. I just into a cheaper by the dozen scenario.
Well, thank you again, Casey. This was awesome. And we can't wait to talk with you again in the future.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.